Hi there, it's Ed here with a short message before we start the pod this week. Did you know that our most informed investors get insights, articles, and investment ideas from Tom, me, and the team sent directly to them via email? And it is completely free. You can join them. Just subscribe at fidelity.co.uk/newsletters. Hello and welcome to the Personal Investor Podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, how much do you need to give yourself for a comfortable retirement? And will you need to work into your 70s to get it? There have been important contributions this week to the debate on the future of retirement, and that is our focus today. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. How much money will you need when you retire? And how long will you have to work before that can happen? Those questions are fundamental to all of our lives, of course, and by extension to our finances as well. After all, the reason we sacrifice money today, save that money, and risk losses by investing it is so that it can one day pay for us to live in the future. So how much we'll need and when we'll need it really matters. And there have been some important contributions in the past week on just those questions. To talk them over, I'm joined this week by Andrew Oxlade, my colleague here at Fidelity, who has written on some of this over the past week. Andrew, welcome along.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for having me on the show.
Last week saw some interventions from a couple of respected think tanks. We had the International Longevity Centre talking about the need for a faster rise in the state pension age. We're going to come on to that. But I wanted to start, if I can, with the PLSA. That's the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association. They put some figures on how much money is required to provide different levels of lifestyle in retirement. What did they have to say?
Well, these are, I mean, this figure is the crucial figure that everybody wonders, okay? Mm-hmm. It's the how much do I need in retirement question. It will dictate how much you need to save to get to that figure. And it's very difficult to work out because you don't know what you'll need. So all credit to the PLSA. Every year they try to work out what that is. They base that on focus groups and whatnot to decide what is required and put out these figures. But the real shocking thing that we've seen in these numbers is the sheer speed at which the cost of living for retirement has leapt in the last year. Now, we've got inflation. Everybody knows that. Everyone knows the cost of living story. But these are big numbers. You know, for those who are looking for a moderate level of retirement income, they're estimating now that that's actually risen by 34% in the last year. 34%. So that's up to $31,300 for a single person. For a couple, it's up to $43,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Now they bracket it into three ways. That's the moderate. Yes, that's there's the a minimum, and then there's comfortable. So that's the sort of slightly higher figure. That figure has risen far slower than the other one, as in 15%. Still a massive rise, but 15% up to 43,000, compared with the 31,000 for the other number.
Yeah, so £43,000 for a comfortable retirement for a single person. As you say, that's a rise, but not as big a rise as it has been for the moderate levels of income. Look, there's a few things to unpack here, isn't there, on these PLSA figures, because you know, you've spent a lot of this week looking at the methodology for this, as have I. They are figures for expenditure, aren't they? They're what you need to spend to get that, what they call a comfortable level of retirement, moderate level of retirement. And obviously the things that you need to spend money on have risen in value. We all know that. Inflation, cost of living, energy, food, etc. But actually what the PLSA do, and part of the explanation for these big rises this time, is that they've gone out and asked people what that comfortable retirement looks like. What do they want to be doing? Where do they want to be doing it, etc.? And some of that accounts for this change, doesn't it?
Exactly. I mean, it's probably helpful just to hear. And I mean, I've got it here in front of me, actually, the comfortable retirement living standard and what that's actually based on. So they put that down as can expect to have luxuries like regular beauty treatments, important for me and you, Ed, theatre trips and 2 weeks holiday in Europe a year. So that's just the kind of flavour of the sort of things they're talking about. Is a couple could spend £291 per week on food and drink. So that sounds like a decent amount. Yeah. So it's all very sensible stuff the way it's compiled. What's odd this year in terms of that difference between the huge rise in comfortable and the more moderate rise for moderate?
Yeah.
is around how they've decided what goes into the basket, if you yes. like. And they do that by getting together sort of focus groups of people in retirement and asking them what that looks like. And therefore, it's quite subjective, and it would be down to every individual. But to understand these numbers, what's changed is the comfortable group previously said that they always wanted two cars. And that's changed this year, and they've decided that they'll only want one. And of course, what you can see across the figures for the top two groups, the bottom group doesn't drive.
Yeah.
So the top two groups do own a car, but it's only one car and gone from two to one in that top one.
Yeah.
And of course, its motoring costs has been one of the biggest increases recently, particularly car insurance. There's been some sort of brutal rises in the last year after a period of when it was very flat.
And one of the things that caught my eye in that detail within the PLSA work was that, as well as things like cars, it's eating out for this moderate group. Suddenly, as opposed to 5 years ago when they last drew these assumptions up, people say they want to be out with friends, with family, eating out way more. They want, I can't remember the figures exactly, but they want a significant extra amount per week to spend on that. And that's not something that's necessarily gone up in value, although it probably has, but it's something people are choosing to do more in their retirement. And so as these assumptions change, things can go up for that reason alone. I mean, you've mentioned that in the minimum group, we haven't spent much time on that minimum retirement group. They don't have a car in the PLSA assumptions, but they do go on a week's holiday in the UK, I think that is.
Yep, that's right.
Now, some people will say, well, I don't care about going away for a week, but I do want a car. You know, the point about these exercises is they're never going to match up with what you personally want. They are kind of an amalgam, aren't they, of focus groups.
They are. And there's actually a very good solution to this. Here comes the plug. But we did, there's a calculator on the Fidelity website. It was built a number of years ago that gets updated with this data. And it allows you to tweak these scenarios, basically, so you can find one that's more appropriate to you. So I would definitely recommend doing your homework. And that's a good starting point to do that, so you can work out that figure. When you're looking at the figures, and this is something, Ed, you've spoken about lots in the past and done some analysis on, these are figures that you need just for the living cost.
Yeah.
But this doesn't take into account what the income would need to be to provide that. And by that, of course, we mean you'll be paying tax on some of your income, and therefore you need to be earning more than what these numbers are.
Well, just before we came into record, I looked at it at a very high level. For that, I think it's $41,300. That's a single person. That's what they need to be able to spend for a comfortable retirement. You could look at that as a kind of a post-tax figure, broadly speaking. Before tax, it's something like £51,000, give or take. So that's the first thing people might want to have in mind. You know, that sort of level of income in retirement, not easy to come by. You know, you could do another calculation that tells you how much you need to save to get that. It's a lot. And the other thing to say is be in a couple, if you possibly can, in retirement, because as their numbers show, relatively speaking, you're costful, don't they? There's a lot of shared costs as a couple. Single people pay a bit of a single person's tax, don't they?
Absolutely. And that kind of leads us to the other sort of the big caveat with this data, which is it doesn't include property housing costs.
It
assumes that people will have paid off their mortgage, which has probably been largely the case, or most people have, and won't have the mortgage cost, and that those renting will largely receive state support to pay for that. But it's going to change, isn't it? I mean, we can see that in the
it
property
does.
Market.
And in fairness to the PLSA, they flagged this. They say, look, we're assuming this, that people now don't typically have housing costs. They understand that's going to change. No particular debts in their assumption either. You can see how the way a lot of these issues are going, these numbers are going to get a lot bigger in the future, aren't they? Quite soon.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's going to become more of you'll see it year by year, I should imagine, with that housing change, just the demographic of who actually owns and who doesn't.
Yeah, indeed. And as a segue then into the second part of our conversation today, in the minimum standards for the PLSA work, they say that actually, if you're a couple and you have the full state pension, you're pretty much covered in terms of a minimum standard of income. That's because the tax system is advantageous, isn't it? If you're a low earner, you're not paying much tax. And that takes us on to the state pension. Because the other contribution last week we had from the International Longevity Centre, talking about a potential, or the need at least, for a further rise in the age at which you are able to receive the state pension to 71, which is going to be pretty hair-raising for lots of people. I'm not sure I want to be working at 71, but it might be necessary.
Come on, Ed, you'd love to be working. We'll be sitting here doing this at 75. We'll have a great time.
I love my job. But look, you looked into this. You've written on this in the last week. What were the ILC saying about the state pension age?
So the first thing I would say is don't panic. So these things are all think tanks and all sorts of bodies who come out, pressure groups with ages that they think this should be this and that should be that. And that said, mm-hmm. the state pension age is rising, and people need to be aware of how it's rising and keep ahead of that and make sure they update their plans to accommodate for that. The state pension has become a bigger part of your retirement income planning because it's mm-hmm. risen so fast under the triple lock. But that's also then created some affordability problems. But just to take to the first point, where are we at the moment? So basically it will rise to, it's already risen to 66.
Yeah.
It will rise to 67 in the next few years, in 2026 to 28. And then at the moment, legislation dictates it will rise to 68 from 2042 to 2044.
Okay.
So that's the law as it stands. However, they meet once a parliament to decide whether that's the right way to go. And up until now, it's all been one way. So it generally has been coming closer and closer as the cost has risen. And because, of course, life expectancy has climbed and climbed. And that's the whole reason we need the changes anyway. You know, when the state pension was invented in 1909 or first paid in 1909, you know, it was higher. It was 70 for one anyway back then, and longevity was in the 50s. So, you know, very few people actually got it. Yeah, so it's a great kind of system for the government.
Yeah.
And now, of course, it's swung the other way, and so you'll live a lot longer now than you would have done even 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And so they need to be able to afford it. So one of the, just to come back to what might be brought forward, was in the last review, the one before last, they did talk about a 2036 to 38, which would involve bringing forward that rise to 68 by about 6, 7, 8 years. And these things all staggered, of course, to be able to do it gently, which I think would affect you, Ed. Is that right? That would capture you.
You'll get captured
by the sea. I'm 50, so that other raise, if they did bring that forward, that would also capture me into that 68 age bracket. And these things are important as well, not just because of the state pension eligibility, but also what I call the private pension age as well. So there is a private pension age of 55, as it always has been. That is basically, there's an aspiration to keep that 10 years below the state pension age.
Yeah.
But what they've done with the 66 is they haven't taken it to 56. They're just going to jump straight to 57.
Yes, they are.
And 58, actually, sorry. But you need to plan for that for the future. As that increases, it will be 10 years below. So this isn't just about the state pension age. And that's when you can access your money, get your 25% cash-free amount, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, look, as you say, you know, this is a story which has been in train for years, hasn't it, really? The need for rises in the state pension age on affordability grounds, the justification being longer living. But the road to this is not smooth, is it? Because longevity data goes up and down. Mm. You know, it's not just a smooth, gently rising line. There were plateaus and even falls in life expectancy, which sort of slightly upset these numbers. And as you say, it's painful. Not, you know, I can notionally sit here and say, well, 67, 68, what's the difference? But with the state pension age, the state pension being, what is it, almost £12,000 from next year.
Mm.
That's a lot of money, you know. And if you think about how this has changed just in the past few years, it's now 66 for both men and women. Not so long ago, it was actually 60 for women, 65 for men. So for women, you know, looking at their retirement prospects, it's a huge difference. From one generation to the next, being able to retire on a state pension age at 60 is now going to be 68 and beyond, perhaps. That's tens of thousands of pounds difference, isn't it? And
it is. And in fact, it did, in the last review, it did get talked about going up to 69 and in the towards the end of the 2040s. Mm. So that's not legislated for yet, but that was the sort of intention direction. I mean, to come back to your original point around this has been going on a long time. I mean, this all goes back to the what used to be called A-Day pensions in 2007. Well. We worked together then in the industry and we could see it then. You know, every time you talk about pension ages rising, that's the one thing that gets people really engaged in this stuff, because of course we want to control the age at which we retire. We don't want to be told when we're going to retire. Mm. We want to be able to put ourselves in a position to be able to choose that age. And that's the one positive thing that comes out of these spells of people becoming more engaged and realizing how and when they're going to do it. And the history of this thing has been, there's some notions that underpin all of it, which I think we can hang on to. One of them is that, and this was the coalition government, that an aspiration that people should spend around a third of adult life in retirement. And so that gives you an understanding of where they're going to go. And they pin all that, to your second question, to the longevity. And the longevity was always increasing at a set pace and or a forecast pace. And that forecast has changed quite significantly. And a lot of it to do with COVID, of course.
Yeah.
And it's still rising, but it's just not rising as fast. And hence why they've sort of pulled back a bit and pushing quite so hard for these aggressive rises, which is also why I then would be cautious about some of these warnings that you see about around 20, around raising the age to 70 by say 2050 is probably unlikely to happen. The second consideration is healthy life expectancy. So it's not just about your life expectancy, it's also about when you actually fall ill. I saw some stats over the weekend that was talking about places in the UK, Blackpool, Belfast were mentioned, places of average healthy life expectancy was between 55 and 57, I think it was. And that is on a par with Burkina Faso and Angola. I mean, it's quite dramatic how, there's that regional variation, but also these ages, are not increasing at the pace that they have been and not as fast as have been expected. And that really undermines the argument for then bringing the state pension rises forward.
Yeah, and by implication, if people aren't, if they don't, you might live longer overall, but if your years of healthy life remain the same, these changes are going to seem like a slap in the face, aren't they? Because how are you supposed to work that long? And this is going to be regional differences. One, just differences based on the type of job and career you have. Who wants to be a fitting, guttering and roofing, or whatever it is.
Quite. I mean, some jobs it's just not possible to carry on doing that. I mean, I think what's interesting is there was a book a few years ago called The 100-Year Life, 2016 it was. And it's fascinating, and it raises all these topics and frames it more in the what would your life look like to cope with a 100-year life. Mm-hmm. We're always talking about saving more. You do need to save more, et cetera, et cetera. You need to save early. It makes a massive difference to how much you'll accumulate. However, you may also want to think about differently about how your life is going to pan out. And the argument made in that book is that the traditional, education, employment, retirement in three blocks may not be how it works in the future. And that we turn to, maybe you get to 60, 65 and you go into a different career. You go into becoming an entrepreneur. We saw a lot of it in COVID, actually, where people would then be sort of selling stuff online or doing other secondary levels of income, which may enable them to give up their main job and just rely on that. So there's a kind of degree of trying to reshape how it might be, because the point made in the book is if you can get through to your 80s, I mean, this sounds crazy, doesn't it? To your 80s and still work, but not in the way you're working, say when you're in your 40s, then of course that completely changes the dynamic of how much you'll save and how much you'll need.
Yeah, exactly, because there's so many things working against you, right, with the maths of this. You're going to live longer, that's got to be paid for, you're not going to get your state pension till later. The pensions that you're saving into are probably less generous than they've been in the past. One of the things you can do to pull things back in your favour is to work longer. And as you say, that doesn't have to mean like the 9 to 5. If you were able to have work which was fewer hours, less impact, closer to home, all sorts of, easier work, frankly, or sort of less sort of full on, maybe that would be fine. I mean, my parents are both relatively early into retirement. They could work. They do voluntary work. I mean, they don't particularly want to, but that it's not beyond them to be able to do that if it was all, if more on their terms and in a way that suited them. And it's probably quite a good idea for people younger to get used to that idea, get used to the idea of, well, what does this second career, third career look like?
And you're already seeing it anyway, aren't you, in terms of changing employment patterns. Digital nomads is a great example, isn't it? So there's people more commonly traveling around the world, work wherever, to hotspots like Lisbon, where there's a lot of Britons now working there, but actually working for UK companies. They spend a couple of months, and of course they're limited how long they can be in Europe, etc., but they can do that and move around to different countries, carry on working for UK companies, and their working patterns throughout their life, they're already getting into the mode of a different way of working. Now why you wouldn't want to do that in retirement is a good question to ask yourself. That might be a good way to live.
Indeed. Well, look, we've covered absolutely loads here. A rambling chat around the future of retirement.
We love a ramble.
We do. We're bound to return to these issues again and again, I think, Andrew. But for now, that is all the time we have. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Ed.
Please note that the value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. Investors should note that the views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. This information is not a personal recommendation for any particular investment. If you are unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to one of Fidelity's advisors or an authorised financial advisor of your choice. Overseas investments will be affected by movements in currency exchange rates, and investments in emerging markets can be more volatile than other more developed markets. Reference to the specific securities should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities, and is included for the purposes of illustration only. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances, and all tax rules may change in the future. Withdrawals from a pension product may not be possible until you reach age 55, 57 from 2028. This podcast may not be reproduced or circulated without prior permission. No statements or representations made in this podcast are legally binding on Fidelity or the recipient. This podcast is meant only for UK residents and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation in any jurisdiction in which it may be unlawful to make such an offer or solicitation.